Hey guys, before we record today, I want to go ahead and give everyone a heads up that Ben and I are going to be talking about Kevin Porter Jr. today. I wanted to wait until the NBA's investigation of the allegations were over before podcasting about it, but it looks like the league is going to take their time with this. So right off the bat, I think I can speak for both of us when I say I found these allegations to be horrific. And if Porter Jr. is found guilty of them, not only do I think he shouldn't play another NBA game again, I think he should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. I really want to emphasize that point because I want it to be clear where both of us kind of stand on this subject. No matter what we talk about in this episode, that point kind of hovers over everything. Do not misconstrue us recording an episode about it with us being insensitive about it. We're both extremely sympathetic to the alleged victim here, WNBA player Kaiser Kondrzak, and we both hope that she gets the justice she deserves if these allegations prove to be true. And by the way, don't take my use of the word alleged in that statement or allegation to mean how I feel about what happened here. You know, my opinion here is irrelevant as I'm not a lawyer, nor am I as well versed in the details of this case as the prosecution likely is. But if you are curious as to how I feel, from the reports I've read about what happened, the case against Porter appears to be pretty strong, and I'm inclined to believe the victim here. But that's not why we're here today. We're not here to discuss the legal ramifications. We're going to be talking about the basketball side of this. But I did want to go ahead and give that disclaimer before we started today. What's up, guys? Welcome to this podcast. My name is Solomon Ali, at Solomon Ali NBA on Twitter. Here joined by Ben DeVos of USA Today Sports. Ben, how are you doing?
Doing well, Solomon. It's a AL West Championship Sunday for the Astros, my friend.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of baseball talk going on Twitter. I am... definitely not well equipped to talk about it, but I'm excited. We're definitely rooting for them.
We got to get baseball fan Solomon to slander the Rangers and Mariners for some pretty
Rangers
epic choke
suck.
Jobs.
Oh my God!
There
Rangers
you go.
Are terrible. Yeah.
Proud of you.
Yeah. It's Dallas, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I brought you on today to preview Rockets Media Day tomorrow.
Yep.
But before we do that, I wanted to discuss KPJ, and
sure.
I recorded a huge disclaimer about the sensitivity of this subject, so we don't have to walk on eggshells here.
Sure,
The allegations are horrific, but I want to discuss the basketball ramifications here. Let's just start here and get this out of the way. The NBA is still investigating the allegations, so technically we won't get an official decision for a little bit here, but it's just you and I here, and we can kind of be honest about this, right? Like, there's no way the league actually voids this contract. Like, I know that's been discussed as a possibility, but I'm telling you, there's no way the league wants to have that battle with the Players Association because, as of right now, KPJ has not been convicted yet, right? And I just think the league doesn't want, or the Players Association, regardless of the horrific nature of the allegations, they don't want that precedent to be set for the rest of their players. And because of that, they're going to fight it if they try voiding the contract.
I wouldn't say there's no way, because I do think if ultimately he's convicted, then this could be an opportunity for them to sort of lay the groundwork like this is a case because it's so public. And if the allegations are true, it's so awful that I could see them wanting to set an example. But I agree with you in terms of precedent, in terms of a potential battle with the Players Association. They're not going to do that anytime soon while so much of this on the criminal side is still pending. So while I do think it's possible that eventually down the line, some or maybe even all of the deal gets voided, I don't think it'll be early enough to materially help the Rockets in terms of their situation, which is the point, in terms of do they keep him for the time being and just, you know, ultimately waive him? Are they able to trade him for an upgrade in terms of that, you know, combination of bench shooter role, but also obviously tradable salary for the future? We've talked about that in the past. I think in terms of how it impacts the Rockets, the NBA would not act on avoiding of KPJ's contract early enough to materially impact what Rafael Stone is trying to do.
Yeah, and that's really like what I more so meant, right? Like it's help the Rockets if that were to be the case, because the timing is just not going to work out.
I mean, maybe there's a small chance that, you know, a team acquiring KPJ is more willing to do it because
right.
they feel like maybe down the line some of that money gets voided, but yeah, only very small. It's not going to be a big needle mover.
Right. Here's what I'll say. Like, if a trade materializes, I think the league may like want to set that precedent. So they'll let the investigation go on until the criminal trial and until he's convicted.
Right? I actually actually think, I don't know if you've read this, but the other day, Jonathan Fagan did an article in the Chronicle, and I thought he summed it up well. Basically, and this all comes down to precedent, because the league has to worry about how the players' union would respond. If the Rockets are to waive KPJ, probably the earliest they could do so would be at the end of the preseason and say it's a roster cut move, as you're trying to get down from, you know, 20 to 15 plus 2, or I guess now 15 plus 3 two-way deals. They introduced another one this offseason. But the point is, like, that's a move that there is precedent. So if the Rockets wanted to waive him, it could happen at the end of preseason. It's not going to happen now, because what possible reason could there be other than the arrest? And at that point, the Players Association might step in. And so that precedent, while it applies to the Rockets, it does not, and Jonathan was making this distinction, necessarily apply to other teams. Because all the time we see teams trade for guys simply as salary filler and then dumped. I mean, basically they're traded for business reasons, not basketball, and then they're let go. So basically, if the Rockets could get someone willing to take KPJ, and say what you will, I think we're largely in alignment on this, I really don't think the politics of trading KPJ are all that bad, as long as the team, and obviously this would be the case, is acquiring KPJ waives him initially. Look, the priority is to keep him from playing basketball. The priority is to not give him the spotlight, hopefully not give him any more money. As long as a trade does not help him in that endeavor, I don't really see what the problem is, logically, ethically, however you want to frame this discussion. So I do think it's possible. Now, whether the Rockets can find the right fit in terms of not just basketball, but contract as well, time will tell. But if the Rockets can find the right fit, then yeah, that team could waive KPJ today. But as far as the Rockets themselves, if they can't trade KPJ and they ultimately need to just waive him because none of the trade possibilities are fit, then yeah, that's not going to be able to happen according to the way Fagan sees it. And I think he's right, because we both know Jonathan does his homework until probably the end of the preseason. And so what that tells you is that precedent is going to guide this entire sort of decision-making tree here, because the NBA is going to watch very carefully, and certainly the players' union as well, how this is handled. Because if it's not handled in a way that, you know, could be a reasonable template for the future, then there might be an objection. And so I think that's where the lines are ultimately going to be.
Right. It's not like the players union like wants to have this battle. They would just be doing it to prevent, like, to protect future players, right?
Yeah.
Maybe a wrongful conviction or something, right? I don't think that's the case here. I mean, I've stated my opinion after reading some of this, the facts of the case here. But let's talk about some of these solutions. You kind of hinted on it, right? Like, the simplest one would be Houston flat out waiving KPJ after this league investigation is complete, or after preseason, right? And I think the Rockets are kind of viewing that as like a last resort scenario.
I agree.
But I do think there's a real chance that teams shy away from doing business with Houston involving KPJ's contract because they're worried about the PR backlash. Even though I personally believe, like I kind of you hinted on, a backlash would be unwarranted, because it feels like people are preemptively mad for no reason right now.
Right.
Like, functionally, it makes no difference if KPJ is waived by the Rockets or by some other team. As you said, like, at the end of the day, like, the goal is to get him to not play basketball again. And both of those, you know, routes achieve that objective. So in my opinion, there's not really a good faith argument to be made involving, like, KPJ's trading KPJ's contract being morally wrong. I don't think you're arguing in good faith here, right? Because there's not. It's going to break down, right? It just doesn't make any sense to me. But getting back to the waiving discussion, I think right now, I'd say it's like 50-50 that the Rockets just waive them themselves. I think there is some chilling effect going on in the market, and that causes me to say I think it's 50-50. But what say you? Where would you place those odds on him getting waived?
I'm going to go 60-40 he gets traded, just because all it takes is one team. And while ultimately I think a lot of teams, I think what's going on here, it's a lot of posturing. Because for the reasons we've laid out, I don't think too many teams are actually concerned about the backlash. Because I think once it's explained to people, it's pretty clear that you are not helping him in any way at all. I think what's going on here is that teams are going to play up that side as a negotiating tactic, Because in theory, you do sort of have the Rockets over a barrel. And so if you're taking this off their hands, then yeah, a smart GM is going to try to use that to his advantage to try and get every possible asset that he can, be it players, future draft compensation, whatever it may be, to take on KPJ and give the Rockets some sort of, you know, useful player or contract for their longer term goals. So I don't think it's necessarily the PR backlash, but it's because that is out there, that's another leverage point that, you know, that smart GMs are going to use. But ultimately, I just think when push comes to shove, as long as the Rockets are willing to attach at least some assets rather than walk away entirely, I think someone is most likely going to do it, especially because the worst case, you know, there might be a few front offices that don't feel like they have the political clout to, you know, go through something like this. But worst case, you know, you can look at the Spurs with Doug McDermott. You can look at, you know, the Heat with Duncan Robinson. Front offices that are proven, that have been there, done that, they're more likely to sort of get the benefit of the doubt in the court of public opinion because they have faces and names that resonate with the public and that are generally trusted. So worst case, I think you can sort of have those on standby and go to them. I would just be, you know, it's close to 50-50. I just still land on the side of a trade being more likely than not, because even if a team, and, you know, a lot of people today have talked about the aftermath of, you know, the Celtics acquiring Jrue Holiday and sending Robert Williams and Malcolm Brogdon to the Trailblazers, there's been a lot of talk of, well, could Malcolm Brogdon be a target for the Rockets, somewhat replacing what was initially anticipated to be the KPJ role? Possibly. I mean, I think it's a worthy pursuit, but, you know, Portland's a kind of front office that's a little less established, it's a smaller market. Maybe they don't want to go through that. Not saying I've heard that, but I think, you know, that's the kind of franchise I do worry a little bit about. Would they, you know, go through it? But even if that's the case, I do think that in a worst case world, my bet is that you can find, you know, I mentioned a few times, a Landry Shamet, Alec Burks type contract out there, or, you know, the two I just threw out there, Doug McDermott or Duncan Robinson. I think you can find something. I think it's close to 50-50. The other angles aren't irrelevant, but I still lean to a trade being slightly more likely than not.
Yeah, and that's why I kind of think that, here's what I'll say. I don't think there would have been a backlash if we didn't get that initial Shams report. Like, if we just got a report that the trade happened and KPJ was being dumped, like, and we didn't get rumors ahead of time, like, there would not be a backlash going on. Let's be honest about this. Like, like, oh, okay, so this is how they're getting rid of him, right?
Yeah.
Good on the Rockets for getting this done, right? Like, because we're hearing that they're exploring this, there's a backlash. There's been time to take it in, right? So,
yeah.
And that's why I think the leak came from not the Rockets, but from another potential suitor to maybe drive that price up. You know, like, oh, give us another additional second rounder or whatever, right?
Because
this is
Yeah.
I think that's probably why the leak didn't come from the Rockets. I think as of right now, I would still say that, you know, as you said, there is that chilling effect with teams that are afraid. Right. Like,
yeah,
I think a team like a front office like Miami, like, they might not be afraid. Right. Because they're perfectly secure. Right. But a front office like Portland or, you know, like a Brooklyn. Right. Like,
yep.
they probably don't have the clout. Right. So let's talk trades.
Yep.
I do think a trade is possible. There are a few players out there that I think could be had in a 1-for-1 swap for KPJ with a bevy of second rounders. I think I don't think you're getting someone like Buddy Hield for just second rounders.
No,
like,
no.
I think you are firmly in that Malcolm Brogdon range.
Yes, absolutely.
Said,
I do
right?
too.
Like, and I know people have discussed Robert Williams. I just think the Blazers want to keep him. And if they were going to move him, they'd want at least one first back. I don't think they're in.
He's not in the available for a few seconds.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason Malcolm Brogdon is even available is because of health reasons, right? Like, that's.
Yeah.
If you were just talking about Malcolm Brogdon, the player, maybe he's not even available because he's not healthy. That, you know, like, he's can be had. But yeah, like, I think you're talking your Duncan Robinsons, your Malcolm Brogdons, your Landry Shamets. Like, these are the tier of players, like, guys who are good players but may only be like sixth or seventh guys for good teams, just because you're basically offering future financial relief and second round.
Yeah.
Is that kind of where you stand on this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think someone that honestly can replace both KPJ the player and KPJ the contract. From a playing perspective, look, the Rockets aren't going to be contenders this year, but they do want to be competitive for reasons that we've outlined plenty of times in the past. And outside of KPJ, there's a lot unproven with regards to the shooting and the floor balance and the floor spacing on this team. So bringing in someone that can shoot threes at a high volume, it doesn't have to be by trade. You know, something I've thrown out in the last couple of weeks, the Rockets are going to be tied for second on the waiver wire order once these preseason cuts come in. So conceivably, you could bring in someone similar to how they brought in Garrison Matthews at the end of preseason 2 years ago, and he, within a couple of weeks, ended up having a key role for that team. So you could potentially add a shooter that way as well. But obviously, you're in a slightly higher higher bracket here with some of the guys we're talking about targeting when we're talking about Landry Shamet, Alec Burks, Malcolm Brogdon. So a guy who can shoot threes at volume in the upper 30s percentage-wise, I mean, that's a real need for this team because there's a lot of athletes, there's a lot of playmaking, but you do need floor spacing. And that's something that, you know, it remained to be seen whether KPJ would actually embrace that role since he's been the point guard the last 2 years. But at least in terms of the theoretical fit, you know, it was important. He's one of the better catch-and-shoot guys in the league the last couple of years. So I think the Rockets need to fill it. But the other thing, too, is that, you know, people can listen to that and say, well, I just want to play Cam Whitmore because he's 19 and it's not like a season you're trying to win anyway. And again, I don't think it's quite that cut and dried for the Rockets. They want to avoid the ride of losing stuff that sort of defined the last couple of years. They want to give Ime Udoka a real chance to put his system in place. But, you know, you can argue, you know, just play the younger guys more. The other part of it for the Rockets, and this may be even more important, is the contract. You want some salary filler because if a big name down the line, and, you know, Joel Embiid is one that I'm watching more than anybody. When you look at, you know, there's already a report from Kelly Eco of The Athletic that, you know, the Knicks and Rockets would be two teams on his list if he asked out. The Sixers, boy, they seem to be striking out everyone. They couldn't get Drew Holiday. They couldn't get Damian Lillard, even though we know they were trying. The situation with Harden is just out of control. So you have to wonder what Joel Embiid, now 29 years old, is thinking. And, you know, when you look at how the Rockets might match up with, and Embiid's just one example, you can look at Zion Williamson, maybe there's somebody we're not even thinking about that ask out by either the deadline this year or next offseason. So the Rockets got two, you know, human trade exception type guys in Jock Landale and Jeff Green. That can get you to about $20 million, but you really need to get above 30 to feel pretty good about making the math work in a trade, because you want to get close to the player's salary without having to significantly detract from the team you have in place. Because the team you have in place is probably part of the reason that you're attractive to the guy you're trying to trade for in the first place in this hypothetical scenario. And so that's where losing KPJ's contract is really important. So I think if you can replace that and somehow be able to get into the 20s and 30s without significantly detracting from your team, then the dream scenario is, you know, to package one of your young guys. Obviously, the Brooklyn assets, those would have to go. And then have a lot of the trade salary filler. That's what KPJ would have been. I think that's very important because every indication I get from the Rockets, Solomon, I do not expect them to go into free agency again in terms of having cap room. Of course, they'll have the non-taxpayer mid-level exception, but I do not think the Rockets are looking at this. You know, there's a few people who have said, well, you know, if KPJ's contract comes off the books and obviously he's going to be done after this season no matter what, then could they dip under the salary cap in a little bit in 2024 or 2025? I don't think it's something that they're looking at. From their perspective, it's such a minimal amount, it's not really worth it, and they're entering a period in which you're going to be due for extensions.
If I may say so, the salary cap is projected to be 142, 144 around there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an underestimation. Like the league is intentionally underestimated.
Perhaps
like the salary cap for the past few years. I think we're talking more like 149, 150.
Perhaps.
And if that's the case, you can get to $12 to $14 million in extra salary if you wanted to. But
if you wanted to, there's two things to consider with that. First off, the non-taxpayer MLE is bigger than fans are used to. When you talk about being above the cap and still being able to have, you know, a starting salary around $14 million a year, if you're an attractive destination and the Rockets think that with the Houston market and Ime Udoka as coach they will be, then you can still get a good player using the NT MLE without having to go under, and you'll have a few other exceptions as well. The bigger point, and this is how I think they're looking at it in terms of Rafael Stone in the front office, is that these days in the NBA, very few true difference makers make it to free agency. They feel pretty good about the core they've got in place. In terms of what, you know, if they were to make a major external addition to this core, they're thinking bigger, and the types of guys that they could conceivably get, those big swings, Joel Embiid, Zion Williamson, those types, They don't typically make it to free agency. They're through trades. So to bring it full circle to KPJ, I think that's why it's so important to them to try and fill that salary slot, is because they want as much non-essential salary as they can. You know, guys that are on mid-tier salaries but not committed more than a year or two, neutral value most likely. That's what they need, because to them, they're not thinking about potential cap space. They're thinking about trade math down the line, and that's what they need to replenish, assuming KPJ is off the books.
Well, that's kind of why I think they're kind of related, right? Like, the potential cap space could get you back to the trade math you want, right? It's just, sure, it's just going to delay the process, right?
Sure.
Like, because now you can't make a trade till January of next year now for, like, that star, right? Like, basically, if you're going to waive KPJ, you're assuming you can't trade Dylan Brooks, right? Assuming, like, a team is not interested in Dylan Brooks, you're waving off the potential of trading for, like, a Joel Embiid until January of next year. And I'm assuming that Houston wants to remain in the market for the next 13 months and next 14 months, and that's kind of why they want to keep the salary spot open. I'm assuming that's their motivation here, because again, you can get back to that math again, but it's going to take some time. And
Woj has reported in the last couple of weeks that teams around the NBA are sort of looking at the next 9 to 12 months as a point in which there could be some seismic activity, mm-hmm, with guys that, you know, we're not just talking top 15 or 20 players, potentially like top 5 to 10 players, where there could be, you know, we've had a bit of relative stability the next couple of years, the Brooklyn Nets excluded. That might be about to change in the next year or so. We're not quite there yet, but we could be there as soon as the February trade deadline, more realistically next offseason, and the Rockets want to make sure that they're in decent position for that if and when the time comes.
I mean, last week Giannis was just talking about exploring possibilities, and now obviously that's the math has changed there. You still have Joel Embiid that could be looking elsewhere. You still have Luka Doncic that could be looking elsewhere. You still have Zion.
Stuff changes on a dime.
Yep. Has always been looking elsewhere. Zion, ever since he got drafted, has been looking elsewhere, right? And you don't get the chance to get league changer guys like that often, right? And that's why I would understand why they might want to refill that salary spot as quickly as possible so they can have that runway.
Exactly.
To make trades, right?
Yep.
Yeah. But yeah, it's certainly fascinating, the motivations for making a trade here. I do think we are kind of underestimating the pressure to win this year. Like, I think that's also a part of it. Like, I think they do want another helpful player.
Right.
Like, I don't think they're going to do this for, like, a guy who's just not going to play. Right. They're going to do this for a guy who's going to play, like, 20 to 30 minutes a game and probably, you know, be a key contributor for the team. Right. That's kind of why they want to replace KPJ.
Right.
So it's gonna be interesting to see who they eventually get. So, very briefly, we don't have to talk, you know, too long about this before we move on to Movie Media Day. Looking back at this KPJ saga, because I'm seeing a lot of criticism for Rafael Stone here. How badly do we think the Rockets messed up? Because I actually see, here's the thing. I don't think the Rockets messed up as much as people are making it out to be. Because
same.
The risk that they put in at every step along the process was not that much. They traded nothing for him, right? They gave him a contract that guaranteed him almost nothing. And now they're about to rid their hands of him for almost nothing, right? So, like, the risk at every step along the way was almost nothing. And I like betting on guys like KPJ to turn their lives around. They're 21 years old. Like, I'm sorry. Like, I'm not going to give up on 21-year-olds, right? Like,
yeah.
I think this idea that you should never, like, put in some real, you know, time with a young man like that. I think that's wrong.
Yeah. So I want to caution what I say by noting that there may be additional reporting that comes out, and if there were more warning signs than we're aware of, then certainly you can question the Rockets, not just from a basketball perspective, but a human perspective, you know, dealing with this risk. I mean, everyone knew it was a risk. When I've talked to people in the Rockets, they've talked about, you know, the anger management issue being real, but that he was working on it. If there were a lot more warning signs than we know, and they took the risk, then even if contractually it wasn't a big commitment, then at the end of the day, that's something that Rafael Stone is going to have to wear. So, again, some of this is to be determined. And what we say now, if more knowledge comes out later that the Rockets were aware of things that we weren't, then, yeah, it's possible that this could be worse than we know and look worse for them. But ultimately, for me, I'm not as bothered by it as some, simply because I feel like a lot of the extreme outrage is based in theoretical scenarios rather than hard evidence. Like, when you look at the hard evidence, look, they did minimize the damage of the contract. They did give themselves protections. And in this case, you know, you can get out after the first year, basically, just $1 million guaranteed after the first season of the extension. They did protect themselves. And in terms of, you know, everyone's favorite argument that you could have sent him to restricted free agency, okay, you could have sent him to restricted free agency, and his cap hold would have been $10 million. And at that point, we're only talking about a delta of like $6 million between his extension figure and the cap hold. So, you know, I guess you can point out, okay, it costs you, that's pretty much Usman Garuba and Ty Washington's salary. Well, both those guys are on two-way contracts now. Teams around the NBA had multiple chances to claim them on their deals and did not, or trade for them. So I don't think that's a major loss by any stretch of the imagination. It's not just the Rockets. Most teams in the NBA don't see them as players moving forward. In terms of...
There's also a risk there that a team signs him for a much more guaranteed number than what the Rockets extended him for.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's what I was going to get to is that, you know, you get to restricted free agency, and it's been at that point a year and a half since, you know, his last public issue was the New Year's Day incident 2022. It's been a year and a half. The catch and shoot numbers are very good. He's obviously talented. He's 6 foot six. He's versatile. You can't tell me that he doesn't get more guaranteed money than $16 million. I think he gets at least, you know, certainly a full season, but maybe, you know, the figure I came up with was like 2 years, the second year being a partial guarantee, maybe 2 years, 20, 2 years, 25, something like that. Just simply based on the fact that the talent and the numbers are still there, but there's been even more time between, you know, the incidents. So his behavior had improved according to everything that we know. Again, that's assuming there's no, you know, huge incident behind the scenes that we're not aware of and that somehow other teams would have been. But basically knowing what we know, I think he would have gotten more than $16 million guaranteed. Now, maybe, especially because, you know, in today's NBA, people say, oh, who's going to sign him? Dude, the entire league has, or almost the entire league, has the non-taxpayer MLE that we were just talking about. The non-taxpayer MLE starts at like $13 million a year. So, again, you cannot convince me that there's not a, you know, a two-year worst, and this is worst case, you might get more, but worst case, a two-year 20, two-year 25 with a second year partially guaranteed, something like that deal out there. And in that scenario, you're actually worse off unless you're willing to actually let him walk. But assuming you want to keep him, and most people, you know, on my timeline didn't want to lose him for nothing, they understand, you know, sort of the talent gamble that was there all along with this. Assuming you planned on matching and keeping, which was what I heard most people advocating for entering restricted free agency, you'd be in a worse spot because in a scenario like this where it all blows up and you have to cut bait, all that matters is the guaranteed money. It doesn't matter how many years. It doesn't matter if it's $16 million a year for 1 year or $20 million a year for two. All that matters is the guaranteed figure because at this point, you know, it's a sunk cost. He's gone. You can't tell me it's less than 16. You just can't. And so between that and the fact that it, had you signed in this offseason, he wouldn't even be trade eligible until December 15th. You'd be stuck with him. So we wouldn't even be able to go through this exercise. So, you know, I do sort of dispute the framing a little bit that you know, that they tied themselves to KPJ at an extreme level. No, I think they gave themselves some outs. And, you know, what I said on my podcast, The Logger Line, was that, you know, if you were truly in the Chris Mannix camp, that for years you were saying that the risk was more than the reward, that he's a bad apple, to cut him, waive him, whatever, then okay, you get to have your victory lap for sure. Chris Mannix was right. Jonathan Givony was right. He had the reference on one of his podcasts this year to KPJ being a cultural issue. There's a lot of potential... There's a lot of potential considerations, but I would just say that I think most of the objections when it, you know, if you get past the what did it, because even the biggest detractors will admit, look, the Rockets only have 1 year guarantee, and that's not that much. So it gets into the theoretical of how much do they commit in terms of, you know, prioritizing him in the organization. How much, you know, did the reps at point guard and not running your offense through Alperen and Şengün? But again, like, I'm not exactly sure what the alternative is. Like, John Wall wasn't the answer. Dacian Nix wasn't going to work out. This offseason, they did sign a new point guard. It wasn't like they were planning on him to be their point guard moving forward. We lost KPJ. You had 2 months in each of the last two seasons. You know, KPJ, one of the questions for him before all this happened, he wasn't particularly durable. He was missing about 25 games a season. You had 2 months from beginning of January until the beginning of March this year when KPJ wasn't out there. And a lot of people thought it would be this, you know, Alperen Şengün utopia, and it wasn't. And that's not to say that, you know, that's not to blindly defend the Rockets. It absolutely could be true that the Rockets don't, you know, there's people that think the Rockets aren't as high on Alperen Şengün as they should be and that they should run more and they don't understand why the Rockets were going after Brook Lopez in the offseason. And generally the thought is that the Rockets are too low on Alperen Şengün. That's possible. But I think to some extent the KPJ situation has become the boogeyman for that in the sense that they want, you know, a one-size-fits-all reason. And it's just easy to say that this KPJ fascination is, you know, the reason that they weren't able to, you know, get the Şengün usage the way they wanted to. And the reality is, in my opinion, it's not all that. Some of it may also be that the Rockets just aren't as high on, you know, Alperen Şengün as some people out there in the Rockets Twitterverse and Redditverse
and you, for that matter.
and so that's where, you know, that's just one example. There's plenty of others. You know, I want to keep this brief. But the point is that, you know, a lot of the angst over KPJ, the extreme angst, it's built more like, it's built more on theoretical stuff. This idea that because KPJ was prioritized, that it cost other things. And, you know, when I just look at it objectively, I don't, you know, I'm not going to say there's nothing to it by any means, but I also don't think it's absolutely extreme. I think in terms of, you know, the tangible stuff, we talked about the contract, the dollar figure, the year commitments, they protected themselves there. And then in terms of the basketball, you know, I'm not going to say there's nothing to it, but I think some of it's overblown too. I ultimately, while it didn't work out, like at the end of the day, you know, it's a results-driven business, and even though they didn't give up a lot, look, Rafael Stone, you know, he did put some political capital into this guy, and they did stand by him after the New Year's Day incident, and it went bust. And yeah, it's fair to, you know, it's fair to look at this as a wart on his resume. I just don't necessarily think it's, you know, you need to fire this guy tomorrow type thing, right. You know. That's the best way I would put it.
Well, I agree. Like I think, listen, I think Rafael's done a good job on the most part, right? When you look at where the Rockets started from when he took the job and where they're at right now, right? They're in a really solid place right now, even yep. with this KPJ thing hanging over their head. But I do think they're, you know, I'm not going to say there's no criticism. I think there is some validity to the
claim absolutely.
That they could have, you know, wiped their hands of this earlier, right? There were opportunities to, you know, cut bait earlier, right? You know, there was the locker room incident, obviously. That's the most public example. There was the recently reported DJ incident, right? Like, that was, I think that would have been an opportunity. And there's the other criticism, which I also buy into, is, like, they probably gave this guy a little bit too much free rein on and off the court, right? Like, in terms of, like, how, not only just the usage, but, like, what he was able to get away with, like it, versus what other players were able to get away with on and off the court. Like, the guy came in and, you know, in the beginning, G League, earn your reps, you know, then there's injury on the top of the roster, he earns his way in there, right? And then you're sidelining John Wall for, you know, the rest of the season. And that's where I'm like, okay, like, that's kind of strange. And then you give him James Harden's old locker.
The double locker, yeah.
That's kind of strange. And then, you know, he makes mistakes on the court and you're not willing to pull the quick trigger with like you are with other guys. That's kind of strange. But again, from a team planning perspective, they drafted like 5 guards during his time. Like, they didn't let KPJ affect their team planning. They got Jalen Green, Josh Christopher, Ty Washington, Dacian Nix, and Cam Whitmore during KPJ's time, right? Like, they didn't let that like KPJ's presence on the roster impact their bets on guards. They didn't let They didn't let KPJ be a big investment in terms of like risk, right? They limited the risk, right, with every step along the way. They didn't trade anything for him. They didn't commit much guaranteed dollars to him, and they gave themselves an exit ramp off the, you know, so they can get out right now. So I think that's kind of where I stay. I think it's worth the gamble was worth it, but the mistakes were made along the way in terms of just letting in terms of what he was allowed to do while he was here, and when you eventually made the decision. Right?
And like, in terms of the culture element, I mean, you're absolutely right about that. The culture was a problem the last 2 years, but I mean, the Rockets already acknowledged that by going out and spending, you know, top 10 money on one of the top coaches on the market in Ime Udoka. They are trying to reset the culture by doing that. So it's one of those things, like, it's a fair argument for sure, but it's sort of baked into what we already knew. So that's, I guess that's where I go into it as far as, you know, what does it mean for Rafael? You know, ultimately, does it mean that KPJ was a bust in terms of, you know, the transaction value, even if the asset cost was low, both in terms of the initial trade and then the extension being fairly protected? Yeah, it was a bust. It's a miss. But in terms of like the more systemic cultural angles, again, this was already baked in. The Rockets knew they needed to reset this. That's a big part of why Ime Udoka is here and why they spent so much money. And we've heard all offseason that he's very heavily involved, you know, not just in terms of what he's doing on the basketball floor and the X's and O's development, but, you know, having a voice in some of the front office decisions. And again, like, the culture is a problem, that's for sure. But we already knew that. That's why the Rockets went down this road with Ime Udoka. So I guess for me, it's not even so much that I disagree with any of those takes. It's just sort of like, what's new? We already sort of knew that this was. And again, like, KPJ had already lost his starting point guard role. He had already lost, in my opinion, his double locker, all that kind of stuff. So it's not even so much that I disagree. No, the people are right. But it's just like, what has changed now relative to, you know, a few months ago when we already knew the Rockets were moving on from that stuff?
Okay, so let's talk timelines for a resolution really quick before we get to media day.
Yep.
So I think the league probably wants to have this investigation wrapped up before that $2 million guarantee date in KPJ's contract. I think that's what they would want. I'm not sure if that's what's going to happen, but I think that's what they would want, which would be the first regular season for the team that he's on. For the Rockets, that's October 25th. So based on that, I suspect the league wants to have this wrapped up in the next 3 weeks. Will it get wrapped up? I don't know. It depends on if they want to explore waiting for a conviction or not.
Yeah.
And if I'm talking about the Rockets' timeline, man, that's tougher because if they wait until October 25th themselves, they're risking giving him $2 more million, which may not be significant, but I think the PR there could be pretty damaging in that you're giving him money.
You're getting more money. Yeah, I agree.
Right. And then there's the. I think the Rockets have shown us that they have the stomach to sit through uncomfortable situations by, you know, just sending a player home and trying to work out a market resolution. But I don't think they have the stomach to keep him on the roster past October 20th.
Agree.
And if there's no deal, I think they waive him on October 24th. That's just my opinion. That's
I'm right there with you. I don't think they drag this out to the deadline saying that he's, you know, theoretical salary filler down the road. No, if you can't trade him at all now, because it's, again, it's not like they're trying to, you know, move him for an upgrade. It's simply to replace the salary slot. If it's too difficult to do that now, I don't know why it would be any easier in December or January or February. So barring something like a GM outright telling Rafael, and I have no idea why this would happen, you know, a GM saying there's somebody I can't trade now that I would trade for KPJ, and that would only be a newly signed player, and why would they already be wanting to give up on that player? For all practical intents and purposes, I think that $2 million date is the deadline. If the Rockets can't find a suitable deal by then there's probably not going to be one to come. And then at that point, you just got to cut him.
Yeah. So, Ben, as you do every year, explain to the people what Media Day is.
Sure. And I'll try and be quick. Media Day is just an opportunity. You know, it's the kickoff. It's the day before training camp. But it's an opportunity to ask, like, bigger picture questions. Because by the time, you know, of course, it's sort of like the first day of school. What have you done over your summer? That sort of thing. But in terms of, like, media coverage, for the most part during the season, it's more day-to-day. It's more granular. These guys, they have a routine. They have a process. It's here's what went right. Here's what went wrong in the previous game. And so they're just trying to sort of focus one day at a time. Media Day is unique in that it's one of the few opportunities, Media Day and then the wrap interviews after the season is over, where you can actually talk at a higher level about, you know, where things are going philosophically. You know, if we talk about Rafael Stone and Ime Udoka, you can look at it in terms of team building. What are you trying to do with this season? Not just this week, not just this win, but where are you trying to go with this season in terms of players? How is this important to your development? What is going to be new, or what are you trying to bring new to your game from previous seasons? There's just so many bigger picture things that you can ask at, you know, a beginning of season or end of season you know, media availability that just don't really make sense during the season, because for the most part, unless there's a major transaction during the season, everyone with the organization, you know, it's a one game at a time mindset, and that's the way sports run. This is a rare opportunity to look at it through a broader lens, and so from that standpoint, it's refreshing.
Yeah, you know, records,
a 30,000 foot view, so to speak.
100%. Records are 0-0. There's hope in the air. Everyone's excited for the season to start, and we get to ask, you know, some more broad questions. So I ask you this every year: who are you most looking forward to hearing from at Media Day, and why?
So, some people are going to say Rafael Stone, because there hasn't really been any official comment on the KPJ situation. But while the question is going to be asked, I don't have high hopes for what he's going to say with that. Keep in mind, Rafael Stone has a legal background. He started with the Rockets as general counsel. He comes from a well-established law school. I don't think he's going to offer any hot takes, given that there's a criminal case ongoing, the league investigation is ongoing. I think those are largely going to be deflected and say, he's not here, we're going to talk about who is here. And you got to ask the question, but I don't have high hopes for what they're going to say in response to those angles. The guy I actually want to hear from is Fred VanVleet, because there was no introductory press conference. And this is more standard. Unless you acquire like a franchise-changing type player, then for the most part, what happens in the NBA these days, your beat writers are typically at Summer League, and now the moratorium backs up to Summer League. You'll make the player available for 5 minutes in a scrum, and he'll talk to, you know, in the Rockets case, guys like Jonathan Fagan and Kelly Eco. But then everybody else, be it the bloggers in Houston, the TV guys, the radio guys, they'll just wait on them until Media Day, especially because many times the player isn't from, in this case, Fred isn't from Houston, so he's logistically not even in Houston to do a press conference. So, you know, he's got a lot of stuff to do over the offseason, and so they'll punt this back. Well, I want to talk to Fred because I don't think people realize, and I think it's because, you know, the James Harden situation was rumored for so long, I don't think people realize how rare the Fred VanVleet addition is. To have a guy who is an all-star in one of the last two seasons join a team without a co-star that's been at the bottom of the NBA for three straight years, that's pretty rare. I can't think of many analogs in NBA history of a guy making that kind of move.
Maybe unless, Gordon Hayward.
Unless the money is extraordinary, or maybe if it's, you know, the Lakers and the Knicks. Rockets are a good market, but they're not the Lakers and the Knicks. Again, there's no co-star that he's teaming up with. And the money, you know, it is max money, but it's only 2 years. The third year being a team option, you cannot tell me that Fred could not have gotten, you know, a 2-year, $40 million a year deal from other teams, and the Raptors would have been incentivized to cooperate on a sign and trade because, I mean, they're trying to win. Like, you can't tell me, for example, that there wasn't a deal to be had. There were rumors about, you know, the Sixers potentially have an interest in Fred. You can't tell me that there wasn't a world where you could, you know, put together a 3-team scenario where Harden goes somewhere, VanVleet goes to Philly, and, you know, whatever limited assets you can get from Harden go to Toronto, and that helps them, you know, win now because they're not entering tank mode by any means. No, there's something about Houston that appealed to Fred, and maybe it's the relationship with Ime Udoka. Maybe it's the role the Rockets have for him. Maybe he's high on the young talent. Maybe it's the relationship that, you know, his agent Rich Paul and Rafael Stone have built over the years, although I doubt he says that. The point is that this is a more rare situation in terms of a guy of his stature right in the middle of his career, because he's 29 years old. He's not too young. He's not too old. It's not like he's past his prime or anything like that. To make that move from a team in Toronto that's been competitive every year, won the NBA championship in 2019, it's more rare than people think. And the only reason why it hasn't been talked about that much is because Rockets fans were, you know, looking for months at James Harden, who's an even bigger name. But the thing with James is that, you know, even though he's a bigger name, he had the connection to Houston. Fred, to my knowledge, does not have any connection to Houston. So for a guy without that past connection to give the benefit of the doubt, to me, it's more rare than people give credit for. And so I just want to see what, you know, why Houston makes sense for him, what he thinks of this team. Do I think he's going to tell you everything? No. But maybe he sheds light a little bit, because, again, I think this is just a little more rare historically in the NBA than some Rockets fans give it credit for.
Yeah, the only analog I could think of is perhaps that summer where Boston signed Gordon Hayward and Al Horford, and they were like they weren't one of the worst teams in the league, but they weren't a playoff team, right? Like that's probably the only analog I could think of. I would say that's a good one. Like I agree on the Rafael Stone thing. I don't think he's going to give anything interesting here. I think it's going to be kind of boilerplate. My answer would be Ime Udoka. And the reason I say Ime Udoka is because I find him, his story to be fascinating. Not only like just him picking the Rockets from a job perspective, because he had options. He could have went to Toronto. That was real. And from like how quickly he's become almost the face of the organization. Like, the Rockets really haven't had like a face of the organization figurehead since Morey left. And Ime, in the past 4 or 5 months, has behind the scenes garnered so much power, and not only just like the decision making, the cult, like the culture, like what the team wants to do. He's gained such a voice so unusually quick for someone who just signed. And I want to talk to, I'd like to hear from him on like basically, you know, what's the plan here for the season? You know, like what are you aiming to accomplish? How are you wanting to use some of these new additions? Why did you go after some of these new additions? Why Dylan Brooks? Why Van Vliet? Like what specifically motivated this organization to go in these directions? And obviously, I'd like to know like how the offense is going to look, not just around Jalen Green, but I think, you know, Alperen Şengün, right? Like I think that's someone I'm always interested in. I think he's immensely talented, and I'd like to see if it's going to be different under Ime Udoka than it was under Steven Silas. So that's going to be something I'm interested in hearing about for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that, and he's always a confident guy, but I'm looking forward to hearing from Jabari as well. I think, you know, this is a uniquely important year for him, given how underwhelming a large part of his rookie season was, and now he's coming off a summer league where he looked amazing. I think this is a huge year in terms of his career trajectory, and so how he's trying to, you know, build off not just physically but mentally what he did this summer, I think that's going to be a big storyline.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, Jalen Green's like an obvious answer here. We're not saying that we don't want to hear from him, but like, I feel like that's going to be everyone wants to hear from him. He's like the franchise's, you know, highest draft pick since Yao Ming. Of course, we want to hear from him, right? Mm-hmm. But like, it's going to be interesting to see, obviously, what he does this season in terms of a making a jump standpoint. So like, that's obviously we're going to ask him what he worked on, all that stuff, and you know what he answers is going to be interesting. What's one question that's been eating at you all summer that you'd like the Rockets to answer? And by the way, this might not necessarily be a theoretical question, because we've both taken questions posed on this podcast and taken it to media day and actually asked it. So what's one question you'd like the Rockets to answer?
So the obvious one was, and I already gave this away, was with Fred VanVleet, why did you sign in Houston? Besides the money, what was the appeal? Beyond that, since I already alluded to that, I would say for Ime Udoka, how do you balance the need to win now with longer term development? Because there are going to be some tough decisions. You're sort of in that in-between phase. It's not an all-out rebuild like the last couple of years, but you're not contending. So how do you blend wanting to, you know, have some win now pieces versus playing Amen Thompson and Cam Whitmore the minutes that they need to develop? Because at the end of the day, you're not going to win a title this year. The goal is years away, and there's some guys that are more important, your core six most notably, towards that goal. So how do you balance the need for short-term success, avoiding the rot of losing, so to speak, having a positive environment, versus playing the guys and using them in the right ways that are going to be most critical to your long-term future?
Right. Like you, I kind of hinted at the question I'd like to ask in that previous answer. You know, like, I'd like to ask Ime, like, why did you guys as an organization choose to go in the direction you guys chose, right, in free agency, right, in terms of Van Vliet, in terms of Brooks, in terms of Jeff Green, all that stuff, right? That's obvious. The other one would be kind of, you know, and we didn't get to ask him a lot of basketball questions when he first got the job, because a lot of when he first got the job was talking about what happened in Boston and the vetting process with Ime, right? Like, and that was totally warranted. I get it. I get why it was like that. But, you know, from a basketball perspective, how does he view this roster long term? How does he view these prospects long term? You know, what is his evaluation of the talents here, right? I think that's a question I'd like to ask.
Yeah, I think that's a good one.
Yeah. All right. I feel like this media day is going to be, it would have been much more fun if obviously the KPJ thing wasn't hanging over all this, but it's still going to be interesting. It's still going to be very, very newsworthy, and I can't wait. I can't wait for the season to start. God, I can't wait for basketball.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, I think, you know, we let off talking about the Astros a little bit because it was an amazing day for them. I also think that, you know, the success of the Texans the last few weeks and seeing some of the renewed optimism around those parts can show, it reflects, it's a different sport, it reflects how quickly the overall attitude of not just an organization, but a fan base can change once the right leadership is in place, once you're making positive strides, even if you aren't a contender, just seeing the right pieces in place, getting better from one week to the next, having the right culture, which is what the Texans seem to have found under DeMeco Ryans, their new coach. Hopefully that's what starts happening with Ime Udoka and the Rockets. To me, that's sort of, you know, to put a bow on it, it's a good time to be a Houston sports fan, and I think the success, what you're seeing with the Texans and their young team, their rebuild, their coach sort of resetting the culture, that's what you want to see from Ime Udoka and the Rockets. And to tie it all together, you know, with some of our KPJ comments, I mean, they sort of knew that to begin with. That's why they were going down this path, and tomorrow this training camp is the start of seeing that actually start to play out on the floor.
Yeah, rebuilding is all about scratch-off tickets. You want as much of those as you can. Some of them aren't always fun to see fail. This was very disheartening from a moral perspective. But
yeah.
Listen, like this, it happens. Like that's why rebuilding, you should never grow attached to players, right? You should wait until these guys blossom, and then you can, you know, start to build that attachment.
Yep.
Thank you so much for coming on, Ben. Where can we read your work and follow you on social media?
Yep, Ben Dubose on Twitter/X and RocketsWire.USAToday.com for all of your daily Houston Rockets news coverage.
Oh, wow, you're referring to it as X now. Okay, I gotta get used to that. It's technically the name. It's the name. All right, take care, Ben. I'll talk to you down the road.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.